Okay. To set the tone for this meeting, I will read an extract from Chapter 8 to Wives, from page 120. We never, never try to arrange a man's life so as to shield him from temptation. The slightest disposition on your part to guide his appointments or his affairs so he will not be tempted will be noticed. Make him feel absolutely free to come and go as he likes. This is important. If he gets drunk, don't blame yourself. God has either removed your husband's liquor problem or he has not. If not, it had better be found out right away. Then you and your husband can get right down to fundamentals. If a repetition is to be prevented, place the problem, along with everything else, in God's hands. And the topic of tonight's meeting is working step three with a sponsee. And Tim will share anything between 30 and 45 minutes on the topic, after which the floor will be opened for questions rather than the normal sharing. And with that, I will now hand over to Tim.
Thanks, my name's Tim. I'm an alcoholic. I'm just going to share the screen if I can get that to work. There we go. Has the big book appeared on your screen? I can't really see what you're seeing. Okay. Right. So let me go to the right page. So there's a little bit of, I shouldn't really call it filler, but there's a bit of filler between the end of step two and the start of step three. I think the book often does this. It sort of recaps where we've got to just to make sure that we're all on the same page before it goes any further. And there's quite a lot of this stuff actually between 58 and 60 that I want to make sure that the little sponsees understood. Some really basic points. One of the points that comes through loud and clear in these two pages is it's a package deal. You have to do the whole thing. You have to do it thoroughly and you have to do it promptly. So those three things, it has to be complete, it has to be prompt, and it has to be thorough. And there are some things which people miss sometimes. So let's put together some different lines. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And it's going to say further down, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. It says, where does it say about half measures? It says about half measures somewhere. Half measures availed us nothing. There we go. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. So that's all pretty unequivocal. And then, you know what people often say back to you? They say, yeah, but it's progress, not perfection. And now it's absolutely right, but my understanding of this is that what I shoot for is to do everything as well as possible. But even when I shoot for doing everything as well as possible, it doesn't mean that the result is going to be perfect. What I find dangerous is to discount at the level of the effort, because then you're doubly shooting yourself in the foot. We shoot if I don't make full effort. I'm, let's say, coming down from 100% to 80%. And then because I'm not a saint, I'll get 60% results. And I'm starting to get into a danger territory there. So you aim for perfection. But recognize that even if you do everything right, you're still going to be messy in all sorts of material ways. A couple of other points that people always pick up on when I get them to read this, or usually pick up on. There are usually questions about these people who cannot give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. And so people ask about that, and they ask about, and then, well, I mean, it further elaborates. They're naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. And it then talks about the people with grave emotional and mental disorders. And I've thought a lot about this. Bill doesn't elaborate about what this means. And I honestly, I do find people in AA, even the ones who are perennial slippers. I've sponsored a number of perennial slippers over the years. I found them generally honest in terms of admitting what they're doing. People are quite good in AA, I think, about being candid. So I've wondered over the years what this means. When something doesn't work, I look at my own experience, and this is what I share with sponsees, is that I think the honesty that I needed to get sober, and then the honesty I needed to get over some of the problems that I had, was the honesty, number one, I have a problem, and number two, I don't have a solution. Now, that sounds pretty obvious, except have you ever been talking to someone? You say, have you got a problem? They say, oh, yes, I've got a terrible problem with drinking or with their career or their relationship. And I say, have you got a solution? They say, no, I don't have a solution. And then you say, would you like a solution? They say, oh, I'd love a solution. And then you say, right, a solution is this. And you tell them the solution. And then they say, oh, I don't like that at all. And so, about 18 seconds after saying, I have a problem and I have no solution, suddenly you see that there's holding on to the safety blanket. And the safety blanket is it's like playing the Joker. And the Joker is, whatever you throw at me, I reserve the right to override you. If I don't like your idea, well, F you then. And that kept me trapped. I was in sort of work horrors for years, and it looked like I wanted a solution. But what I couldn't be honest about was the fact that my thinking was inadequate to the problem, and therefore I was to pay no further attention to my thinking. That's the bit that I wouldn't admit. Even though I was in the most terrible mess, I mean, this is true with the drinking, but it was true later on with the work stuff in particular and with the relationship stuff. What I couldn't admit was that my opinion and view was irrelevant, that it meant nothing, that my assessment and analysis of the situation were useless. They were useless with the drinking. They were useless with this. And I think that that's the honesty that's required. And there's a wonderful Sandy Beach story about this, where he's talking about something to his sponsor, and he says to the sponsor, you might be right. And the sponsor says, you mean to say you're wrong? And Sandy says, no, I think you might be right. And the sponsor says, I want to hear you say I am wrong. And he almost couldn't say it. He could admit the sponsor was right, but he couldn't admit he was wrong. And I think that's the key point here. It's that honesty which opens all of the doors. And without that, I don't think anything can be achieved. I think I mentioned in a previous week with the chronic slippers, one of with alcohol, one of the continual refrains is, but my head keeps telling me. When I'm in a good space, my head still tells me all the same things. I just don't believe those things. And that's the key difference, that those things cease to be relevant to me. Let's have a look. This is the other line, which I always talk a lot about. To people, some of us have tried on to our hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. And that's really an echo of what I've already been saying, that I have to be willing to listen with an entirely open mind. The habit I've got into with my sponsor, we have very strange phone calls sometimes where I say about 8 words, then he speaks at me for about 20 minutes. I take notes, and then I say, thank you very much. And I think about it later. I don't react, because I want to be applying this. I want to say, well, if I'm calling him about a situation, it's because I don't want any of my old ideas. If I'm unhappy, I must have decided wrong. So I don't want that decision anymore. What else do I go through? So I run through the steps with them, and we've already talked about the we are not saints, so we claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection, And the ABCs really sum up everything we've done so far, that I'm going to die of alcoholism unless something significant happens, that and no human power can relieve my alcoholism. It doesn't mean that there isn't human power used by God to help me. And God could and would if he was sought. And at this point, I just double check that people are down with those ideas, and people always, always are. Now, how down they are with those ideas, you discover that at the bottom of page 63 to see if the step four gets started or not. But that's another question. At this point, people are usually very willing. And I talked about this a bit last week, but I'll obviously go into it in proper detail now. Being convinced we were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood him. Just what do we mean by that? And just what do we do? And it, before it answers that question, it goes on one of Bill W's wonderful digressions, two-page digression, which, so it's just like with step four later on, it's going to say we're going to do a moral inventory, but before it does that, it bangs on about resentment for 3 pages, which has got nothing to do with our moral inventory. It's there for a reason, but it's not what we think it is. And it's a bit like that here. We've already decided we're going to take step three. And so the next 2 pages sets out a philosophical position, which means that when we're turning, if we've already decided we're going to turn our wills and our lives over, the question is, how are we going to become really comfortable with that idea? And the proposition here is, well, you running your life is a disaster, not just in relation to alcohol, but in relation to everything. So if you can see that you're a disaster in every other area too, that sweetens the pill. So hopefully when you turn your will and your life over to God, it isn't going to be a tug of war where you're still holding on to it. You're going to be, get it off me, because you're so done with you being in charge of your life. Now these 2 pages, have got some, as I say, some philosophical points, which I try and convey to people, but honestly, most people don't buy them. There'll be some lip service usually, but people don't fully buy them. And I'll explain what I mean by that. The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. And it isn't immediately evident what that means, any life run on self-will. My understanding of it is that I organize my life based on what I want. And what do I want? Well, it's all the things which I think will make me happy. So the proposition here is, if you live life based on what you want, you won't be happy. It'll be a disaster. And it goes on to explain why. And it gives a little description here of what running the world around you starts to look like. And the problem is, and it says you might be nice doing it or you might be mean doing it, but the show doesn't come off very well. And so the basic idea is, if you go through life with a blueprint, you'll probably find that the world does not play ball. As Earl Purdy says, if ever you're upset by something, it means you have a plan and the plan has been thwarted. If you're upset a lot, it means you have a lot of plans and the plans are being thwarted. So the reason I'm unhappy is not because of the world. It's because I'm going into the world with a plan. And if you've got more than one person in the world, each of whom has their own plan, the plans are going to conflict, unless by some miracle all the plans happen to be exactly the same. But because I'm over here, I have my plan. Because you're over there, you have your plan. And here is the key line. Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest happiness and satisfaction out of this world if he only manages well? And that's like a sort of two-stage punch. So firstly, it's recognizing that, oh, yeah, OK, so I'm operating on the basis that if only I function well, I'll be happy. And then the second part of which is worrying, then the second part of it is the fact it's a delusion. So I'm wrong in that. I'm wrong in that. And the basic idea in these two pages is therefore this. So running life on self-will, in other words, based on what I want. First of all, it's almost impossible to get the world in its entirety to play ball. There'll always be something which is problematical. But my own experience, and if you're sober a few years, you may well have experienced this as well, that you do the program, you do it very well. This gets rid of lots of your character defects. You discover yourself much more effective at work. You discover yourself more effective at home. People are suing you far less than they used to. Your relations generally are more cordial. And you think, well, this is all right. And then you wake up at 5 years or 7 years or 10 years sober, having a panic attack at 4 o'clock in the morning because your life is never going to be fixed and you don't know why, because all of your ducks are in a row and they are quacking, but it hasn't fixed the underlying problem. So the point is that it's almost worse when you don't get your own way. You can still hold on to the delusion, if only I got my own way, everything will be all right. So you keep peddling in, or you carry on being the hamster in the wheel. If only you can pedal fast enough or run fast enough in the wheel, get the wheel to go fast enough, you'll be all right, but you can never get it to go fast enough. On those rare occasions where you do manage to get exactly, it's like the dog that catches its tail. What does it do with the tail once it's caught it? There's nothing it can do with the tail. It is no further ahead. It's now tired and it has its own tail in its mouth. And I think this is a perfect image of most people somewhere between 7 and 10 years sober when everything comes right at last. Not, it's not, there's anything wrong with those things, but they don't fix the problem. They don't fix the thing they were supposed to fix. And if this is all, if this is the case, then there has to be, this is the great line which gave rise to A Course in Miracles. There must be a different way. And the way I get people to try and see this, if you know, obviously through my experience and their experience, but you look at society and you look at most people have read glossy magazines or the sort of gossip pages of the Daily Telegraph or something. And it's pretty self-evident that just because you're rich, you won't be happy. Just because you're pretty, you won't be happy. Just because you're feted and lauded and loved does not mean you'll be happy. All the famous people who've committed suicide when their lives were absolutely gilded. You walk around Kensington, you go to AA meetings in Kensington. Are people cheerful and relaxed there? No, but they've got everything that you think will make you happy. And it hasn't made them happy, but you still want it. So the idea is the whole system is insane. There must be a different system. People describe this as being the about alcoholics. And here's the interesting thing. It's not. This is why this isn't unmanageability, the second half of step one, because our examples, our actor is self-centered, egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. He is like the retired businessman who lolls in the Florida sunshine in the winter, complaining of the sad state of the nation. And there are several other examples. So, what is being described here is not alcoholics. It's describing human beings. So if you identify with this, you're not identifying with your alcoholism, you're identifying yourself as a human being. And the proposition, which is pretty radical in these two pages, is the entire world has got it wrong. That's the proposition here. Do you want to sign up to that before taking step three? And it has an alcoholic as the last example, not the first. And then it goes in, and then this last little bit, before we get on to the actual step three. What we're looking at here is what is going on inside. selfishness, self-centeredness. So having yourself as the center of the universe, making endless lists of things you think will make you happy, running after them and trying to manipulate the universe into giving them to you. Now, as soon as you want something, you'll have fear. If a person is self-centered, when I'm self-centered, I'm the center of the universe, it distorts the entire perspective. So if you're self-centered, you think that the sun is revolving around the earth rather than the other way around. It changes it, that self-centeredness itself creates a massive delusion. I often talk to people who, whenever they share in meetings, the person that shares after them, they always think the person sharing after them is sharing about them. Or I don't know if you've ever had a situation where someone is very rude to you or unpleasant to you, and you take it personally, as though they were like placid and pleasant and lovely before you walked into the room, and you are so powerful, you can actually change their personalities and turn them into assholes. No, this person is 47. They've been an asshole for 47 years, and then you walked into the room, and then they were just themselves. This has got nothing to do with you, pumpkin. So self-centeredness gives rise to self-delusion. And the more self-centered I am, the more fearful I am, the more distorted my perceptions are, yet the more right I think I am. The more upset I am, the more right I think I am, the more certain I am about everything, and the whole thing is corrupted. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that sometime in the past we've made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. Now, this is tricky. I think this is true as an adult. Obviously, children are placed in situations which they did not choose. Sometimes in societal situations where there are massive power imbalances, this can be the case as well. But I look at my own, most of the people on my step four, out of all the people I met, those were the ones that I chose to be in some kind of work relationship or romantic relationship with. I picked them. Even if they were assholes, I picked them. And so now this all sounds very rough to thrust on someone, but the way I explain it to people is, if you're right and you're a victim and everyone else is wicked and you're just misunderstood, I've got really bad news for you. You're going to carry on being mistreated for the rest of your life. You're going to carry on being unhappy. If, however, it turns out you are the prime mover in your own unhappiness, there's hope, because you can change you. So what would you rather be? Would you rather be the one that has the power in the situation to make different decisions? And people usually buy that. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. And again, it's this idea that even if the situation is not my making, my trouble, for this statement to be true, it has to be true under all circumstances, certainly as an adult, carving out children as a separate question. But as an adult, even if there is a situation which I didn't give rise to, my trouble is my disturbance about it. And the disturbance about it is coming from self-will, is, in other words, is coming from wanting. I understand from my Buddhist friends, of whom I have very few, but they tell me that the problem is wanting. That's where all of the problems start. And that's another way of talking about self-will being at the root of the troubles. And we have to get rid of this. And we aren't going to think our way out of it. And we can't do it on our own. Now, exactly what that means is difficult to explain. The way I put it is this. Whilst I still think I'm the one to figure everything out, for some reason, I block all possible solutions. As soon as I say I don't know and I'm willing to listen, I'm open to influences from the outside. And people often don't believe in God, which is fair enough. But the question is, can the individual trust other people on the basis that those other people are doing better than them? So the idea here is the information isn't good enough. There needs to be a surrender, which, as I said, is a recognition that I don't have the answers and I'm going to have to take action. This is the wonderful Clancy line, taking actions I don't believe in because the person who is suggesting them is doing better than me. Taking actions I don't believe in because the person who's suggesting them is doing better than me. Now we get on to the good bit. And there's one last philosophical point, which I think is worth making. We decided we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. Now, the point here, the Indian Jesuit, Father Paul Coutinho, says that material reality is about 1% of the whole show. So this drama of life, what I've been encouraged to do is to consider it, the material world and everything that goes on it, is like a play going on a stage where in a particular scene, I'm playing a part, but in the same way that the actor is distinct from the part that they're playing, I am distinct from the role that I'm playing. And the role is just the role that I'm playing. My reality is unaffected by the part, by the character and what happens to the character. So the actor that plays Duncan or Macduff is not affected by anything that happens to Duncan or Macduff on the stage. You know, at the end of by the end of Macbeth, I hope I'm not spoiling anything here. There's a little bit of blood spattered around. Yet all the actors sit on the bus on the way back to Neasden, having a lovely old time together afterwards. They're fine. So this gives me an entirely different philosophical way to look at the world. I can look at it one stage removed and not be sucked into everything. I have to play each role diligently as though it's real. I have to inhabit the role. But I am safe, which changes everything. And I have a life and an existence outside the material plane, which changes everything. So we've got several different images here for the relationship between us and God. The first one is director and actor, which is a pretty straightforward image. The second one is principal and agent. Now, if you don't have a commercial background, that won't necessarily mean very much. But it's a very useful one. The image that I convey with this is if you imagine a ship owner who's got these ocean going container ships, and the ships call in at various different ports, and in each port there is a shipping agent. So the ship owner is the principal, and the agent in each port has to attend to the business of dealing with the longshoremen and the customs authorities and the railway authorities and the bunkering the vessel and provisioning the vessel and all of the other things that you have to do when a ship comes into port. But it ain't the agent's ship and it ain't the agent's cargo. He's just got a job to do. And he's paid directly by the ship owner. So it kind of doesn't matter what is going on. He has to do his job well, but his job is to do things well. It doesn't matter to him personally what is going on with the ship, with the cargo. Father and children. I don't have my experience of parents and children is maybe not ideal. So this, I think this is so brilliant here. This is so helpful for sponsees. Is you've got director and actor, principal and agent, father and children, and then employer and employee. And most people can connect with one of those. They've got a positive experience, at least in principle, of one of those. And the employer-employee one is one that works for an awful lot of people. A lot of people can't deal with the idea of God being the father, but they've got bad experiences of parents. But they can, they've had benevolent employers before where they just have to show up, ask the employer what to do, get on with it, and they get given money and go home. the actual taking of step three, the first point is to understand what the contract is and then to adopt that position. And the position, the contract is very simple. He provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. So I need to do two things. Stay close to God in steps 10 and 11, perform his work well in step 12, and obviously do 4 through 9 to place myself in that position. And those are the only two things I need to concern myself with, is staying close to God and the next right action, staying close to God and the next right action. And that's the contract. And I adopt the position of God being the employer. In my case, it's the employer-employee one that I connect with the most. I mentally adopt that position in the same way that when you get given a job offer and you mentally assent to it, the job is already yours. You're going to have to sign on the dotted line, but essentially, conceptually, you've already signed up to it. Signing on the dotted line, I think, is saying the step three prayer. So you've got two things now. You adopt the position mentally. You sign by saying the step three prayer, and then you get on with a couple of things. And the two things you get on with are steps 4 through 9 as a discrete exercise, maybe an hour or two a day until it's done. And then 10, 11, 12 instantly as a way of life. Sometimes people say the steps are in an order for a reason. And there is some truth to that, although it has to be understood that the original 6 steps, although exactly what those steps, 6 steps were, there's some contention about that, were in a different order. So the AA program, as it was acquired by the early AA members, was in a different order. The idea was not that you move in a sort of stately manner from one to another. It's that you adopt the whole way of life all at once in a very short time and then spend the rest of your life living it. So the notion, for instance, that you don't start step 10 until you've completed step 9 is silly, really, because if sort of 10 or 20 years you need to be directing your attention to doing the right thing, how much more so if you're new? And the same with 11, the same with 12. You know, I got put onto service really from day one. So the program, I think, has got 3 parts. There's 1 to 3, which is your preparation, 4 through 9, which runs along one track, which takes a few weeks or months to complete usually. And then 10 through 12, which is a daily cycle. One of the things it says here, which I get people to do, most people are fine with the step three prayer. If they don't like this, they can reword it as long as it doesn't say something completely mad. The NA step three is amazingly good. There is a little step three prayer in the NA book, which is in sort of plain English as opposed to King James. One last thing, a couple of last things with this. I get people to consider overnight, by the time we're about to take step three, I get them to consider whether they're willing to go at steps 4 through 9, go through those like a dose of the salts, or whether there's any reservation to doing that, because there's nothing worse than getting halfway through and discovering you've run out of steam because you've got the handbrake on for some reason. So, and very often very major reservations come out of that like 24 hour consideration period before they take step three. Sometimes I get people to take it over the phone with me. I haven't really done it in person with people much. I don't see any correlation between whether or not people take step three with me over the phone or in person and whether they get through the remaining steps. I think it's entirely an internal thing. I've had people where it's been terribly moving, do a wonderfully moving step three, and you literally never hear from them again. So I don't know what that was about. And other people, it all seems very perfunctory and businesslike, but they get through the steps in a few weeks. So you can never tell from the outside by the sort of external manifestation of religious or spiritual sentiment whether there's any depth to it. You only tell if you give them the first instruction of step four and see if they get on with it or not. So I'm going to pause there. I'm going to suggest, Alistair, that we see if there are any questions on that. And if we have, if there are no, if there aren't many questions and we've got some spare time, maybe I could start the step four this evening. What do you think?
Sure. Okay, Tim. Thanks. Yeah, so at this meeting, as I mentioned at the beginning, we it's more of a workshop, and the floor is now open for questions. If you have any, and this can be done by the raised hand option or just waving your hand at your camera, or you can send me one on the chat. I do have that open as well. So, Sara Rivka, you have a hand raised.
Hi, thank you so much. I do have a question. I've often had the experience of working with a sponsee who says to me, I have a very strong belief in God, but I think that God hates me and is punishing me. I mean, maybe this technically comes under step two, but the problem is when it comes to step three, they're reticent to turn their will and their life over to this, you know, person, well, not a person, I'm sorry, but a being who hasn't been, in their opinion, has not been fair with them. Do you have any suggestions for that?
Absolutely. But can you say a little bit more for us, Arifka, about, give an example of what they're characterizing as God hating them or God punishing them?
It's like, God hates me. He never gives me what he wants. You know, my life is horrible. And of course, in my opinion, this person has a perfectly fine life. But they're looking at it as, I'm not getting what I want when I want it because God hates me. And perhaps that's a punishment. Maybe I'm being punished for some reason, because if God was so loving and kind, why don't I have what I want? That's the gist of it.
Right. That's a really good question. You've actually, there are actually seven or eight individual questions buried in that one question. And with your permission, I'll go through what those are. I'll take little notes to make sure I get through all of them. Because they cover basically the full range of issues you have. It's much easier dealing with atheists and agnostics because they aren't sophisticated enough to have thought it through. It's often religious people are the hardest because they've been thinking about it for the last 40 years. So there's a lot more deconstruction before you can get to step three. But sometimes, you know, even without much religious background, people can build up a real animus against God. Okay, so the first thing, the first problem is where you've people's image of God is Santa Claus or some kind of personal servant or skivvy, where the relationship should be you snap your fingers and God does what you want. And I think that the way you, I don't have a huge amount of patience with that one, because it rather sort of that should be a fairly easy bubble to pop, at least intellectually, that the purpose of God is not to serve you. The purpose should be the other way around. What's much harder? You've got a second situation. So the Santa Claus one, I find people, if that's the only thing they've got going on, that's a fairly easy obstacle to overcome. Most people are well-intentioned enough to realize that there's selfishness inside that. The second situation is where you've got basically a complicated, messy life, where it's just like regular messy. So, you know, lots of entanglements and, you know, you're surrounded. There are lots of difficult, schmucky people around you, and you feel very much victimized by it. So it's not that, you know, God hasn't given me a Rolls Royce and unicorns and lollipops. It's that everything is a mess and God's doing it to me. If people are genuinely open-minded, that you can usually have a conversation, you take a couple of worked examples of the situation on page 62, where it says, we made a decision based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. And you can help people see, and I'll do it with my own experience, but there's a particular story that I tell, to help people see that their fingerprints are all over the scene of the crime. So it ain't God that's doing this. It couldn't have happened without their full participation. And some of you have heard this, so I apologize. French novel, where this kid, his best friend, over the course of the summer, disappears with the family. They go and move somewhere else. He has no idea where the family has gone. So he goes and sees this old Russian emigre photographer, who's his confidant, who's 40 years, 50 years his senior. And he goes to see him, and the man is fiddling with his cameras, and the kid tells the old man, the older man, his story, wanting sympathy from the old man about how to, and basically an ally against this terrible boy, Nicolas, who has deserted him. And the old man, he says, I'm afraid it's your fault. He said, this boy, Nicolas, has behaved very badly. Is that right? And the boy says, yes, he has. And he says, and you say he was your best friend. Yes, he was my best friend. He said, well, best friends do not behave like that towards each other. Therefore, he was not your best friend. He was not a friend at all. Your problem is that you believed he was a friend. You're lousy at picking friends. You need to pay a lot more attention about who you decide to be your friend. And he says with affairs of the heart, and friendship is an affair of the heart, wishful thinking will often take the place of rational thinking. And usually it doesn't take long to find a few situations. And the most obvious one is, you know, with marriage. Well, who said yes at the altar? With terrible jobs, who said yes when they offered you the job? Did anyone force you to take that job as opposed to another job? Usually, you know, there are choices there. So that's like sort of regular messy life. The third type of problem is basically the way the world is created, which is that we, first of all, and C.S. Lewis talks about this. So the book that people want to read is The Problem of Pain. If you're not Christian, it works just as well with a tiny bit of adjustment. There isn't much Jesus-y stuff, I don't think, in Problem of Pain. There is a little bit more Jesus-y stuff in their Christianity, for instance, but even there, it's transferable in many ways. But anyway, in The Problem of Pain, he talks about the material world, about the creation of the material world. So if you think about human suffering, if you think about bad events that happen, everything from sort of hurricanes to diseases to pandemics to, you know, your neighbor spitting on you when they walk past you on the street, everything is some combination of natural events in which are simply a function of the material universe plus the exercise of human will. Now, I'm not going to go into the full philosophy of why God would allow a physical world where bad stuff happens. But one of the ways out of that is what we were talking about earlier with material reality being only a fragment of the bigger picture. So the fact that bad stuff happens materially is only part of the picture. There is a bigger purpose behind the whole thing. But more specifically, most of the wrongs that people are worried about actually boil down to other people behaving badly. And if you can help people see that they are exercising free will in their lives, other people are exercising free will in their lives. God is not taking people over like zombies temporarily to make them act badly towards you. No, you're just encountering human beings operating with whatever software they have loaded. So it's the setup of the world is not, I think, the sort of deterministic approach, which is literally everything is determined by God, implies that we have no free will, in which case, why are we even talking? Why have a conversation? Why go and have a cup of tea if it's all? I think the premise behind this whole thing is that we have will. If we don't, then we shouldn't even be looking at a program. As soon as you've got the concession that people are exercising will, it's difficult to blame God for those things. The fourth situation, and this is a tougher one. Some people have genuinely had extraordinarily difficult circumstances. I'm thinking of parents who've lost young children, that kind of thing. And I've had sponsees who are in that position, who blame God directly for those. And now I'm not about to get in there and try and rewire someone on a subject like that. I think the closest you can get is suspending disbelief, as it were, and saying, are you willing to set aside the question of why that happened and whether there was a direction behind it, whether there was a purpose behind it? Are you willing to set aside that question for now and return to it later once you've done the steps? And maybe you'll be in a better position to figure out what was going on there then. And most people, if the flames of their alcoholism or their Al-Anonism are licking sufficiently at their heels, that will be sufficient motivation to set aside that. So sometimes there are, sometimes you can actually resolve these once and for all. Sometimes you can't resolve them once and for all, but what you can do is have these questions set aside. And the last point I'm going to make on this particular question is, I think it may be different in Israel. Well, I know it's different in Israel, but I know in this country, when you ask people what religious training they've got or what religious instruction they've had, like the last thing they remember was, you know, Sister Mary Magdalene hitting them over the knuckles with a wooden ruler at the age of seven in you know, St. Eugenia's Catholic primary school in Huddersfield. And they've literally had no religious instruction since then. And yet, you know, people are pronouncing on, you know, the causes of the universe and the music of the spheres. And well, it's all very well, but it is coming from a position of absolute ignorance. So you've got to get the ignorance out on the table. So you're asking really important, valid, interesting questions, but how about you do the steps first and then sign up to a theology course to actually investigate those under proper instruction later on? Because you would no more try and figure out physics or, dare I say, virology on your own by just looking at YouTube clips. Why are you doing it with theology? Theology is no different than anything else. It requires direction and instruction and proper. It's not something you can make up as you go along. And most people will actually buy that idea. The difficulty is when you've got people who've got a lot of religious instruction, and there, I'm afraid, I don't even go there. I just say, how about we set that aside and look at the more basic thing that you can't stop doing X, Y, and Z. You're shooting above your weight here by trying to tackle those big theological problems. Just look at the fact that five people in your home group just this week have made progress in the area you're currently stuck in. How about you just keep your relationship with God as simple as trying to do the steps? And so you just have to bypass the question at that point. I hope that's helped, Sarah Rivka.
Amara, you have your hand.
Okay, thanks. Hi, Tim. Thank you for doing this. Alistair, thanks for hosting this. So the passages that we read, it's sort of, to me, it seems like learning objectives. Like when you take a class and like at the top of the sheet, it's like, what are the objectives for this course? It's like, what are the objectives for doing the inventory? It's to have this awareness, right? Or that's how I see it. Like, I'm just wondering, as a sponsor, do you feel it's our responsibility to circle back with sponsees to go over these mistaken ideas and beliefs and make sure, like, through the work that it's that, like, they're on board with seeing that they're mistaken ideas and beliefs? Does that
make sense? Do you mean specifically about the relationship with God or the higher power, or do you mean more generally about the philosophy of the way the world operates?
I think both, like in the sense, like, to make sure that it's clear that, like, that they're clear when they're operating from the delusion they can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if they only manage well.
Okay, so I think there are levels of understanding. Now, when people are, I find people who are genuinely open-minded, who are genuinely defeated and genuinely open-minded, can usually get on board with those ideas. Let's say the page 60 to 62 ideas, they can get on board with them in a few days in principle. Now, the notion that a life run on self-will can hardly be a success, the worked example is going to be your step four. So that's an example of, you discover, or, you know, in the third column of the resentment inventory, you discover that the reason you're unhappy is because you've gone into the world with a blueprint. You've gone into the world with self-will, a whole shopping list of things that you want to happen, things that you will for yourself, and that is the problem. So the worked example comes later, and that's when it comes through with full technicolor. And then it comes through even more strongly in step nine. And then, you know, the final nails in the coffin get banged into the coffin in step 12, when you have other people coming to you with their self-will, and you can see it from the outside much more clearly than you can see it within yourself. So I think there's a gradual progression. The important thing, what that I find, so, I mean, spiritual growth doesn't stop. So you're always going to be, I think, to be spiritually growing means you have to be challenging yourself. And I'm better at it now only because of the pain of doing it wrong. I'm much better now at when I'm presented with a new idea. I treat the new idea as true and use it as a working hypothesis and let my subsequent experience demonstrate that it's true. And I find, honestly, I find people in AA and who are, or other fellowships who are, as I say, defeated and willing, actually very, very able to do that. Now, it won't go all the way in, but you can hear in people's voice when they want to understand it. It's amazing what does go in, even if it's just at the level of principle, even if it's just at the level of little flashes, like recognizing that, you know, what are the top five things you think will make you happy? For instance, you give them an exercise. What are the top five things that will make you happy? And then you say, do you know anyone that has those things who is unhappy? And just sit with that. Sit with the fact you're pinning your happiness on things which haven't made your friends happy. And people can see it, even if it's just a flash. And the important bit is the flash. There's a medieval commentator called Maimonides who says something to the effect of, I'm sure Evan will correct me here, something to the effect of, it's like seeing a landscape at night lit up with lightning, just a flash for a couple of seconds, and then you spend the rest of your life trying to reconstruct what you saw in that moment of clarity. So if people in this process are open, I think they get those little flashes of clarity, and it takes the rest of their recovery to fill in the details and make that a permanently burnt image onto their retina. Does that make sense, Mara? But yeah, there's a line in Peanuts where someone, I think Lucy says to someone, how many times does four go into three? And they say 4 doesn't go into 3. And she says, it does if you push. Now, with sponsees, it doesn't. If you push, it doesn't. Like, you know, when you're trying to feed a baby and they don't want the food to go in and it just ends up all over their face. That's what's going to happen. Or they'll throw it on the floor and you have to clean it up. So if people are not, if people don't want the new idea, there is no way you can explain it carefully enough to make it go in. So don't sweat it, because it was written to be plain. And it might need a bit of filling in, but basically it's meant to be relatively plain.
I'll jump in with a quick one if I may, Tim. I don't know if you've had this experience where you mentioned you ask a sponsee to go away for 24 hours and ask the higher power if they're ready, really. I have an experience recently of a couple coming back and saying, yeah, I kind of understand that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem, but I think I'm going to fix that before I go to God on my own power, kind of thing. And then I find myself trying to convince them that they can't, and they need to be convinced, not me. I don't know if you've had a situation like that, how you dealt with that. You're muted, sorry.
There we go. I've literally got a quotation about this. This is from Charles Haddon Spurgeon, the 19th century preacher, who wrote, 100 billion sermons, each of which is 14 hours long, and someone wrote them down. It's a miracle. They're very, very Christian, but there's some good stuff in them, the stuff I find really useful in them. He says this: if thou hast made some difficulties for thyself, if thou art such a fool as to be tying knots and wanting to get them untied before thou wilt be believing God, then I have nothing to say to thee, except it were, beware in case you tie a knot that's going to destroy your soul. If you're troubled with an honest objection, I tell you now, in God's name, just ask of God. You do not need to wait till you get home. You do not need to stay till you have left that seat. But now silently in your soul, breathe the prayer: God, teach me, save my soul this day. End the doubtful strife. Answer these questions. Bring me as a humble servant to lie before thy mercy and to receive pardon. Let him ask. That is all. Let him ask. So the short version of that is the reason you're going to God is because you've tied yourself up in knots. You do not need to untie the knots first. How is that going to be quicker? How is that going to help? You might as well. There's something available to help you untie the knots for free. So don't look a gift horse in the mouth. That's what I'd say in that situation.
Thanks, Tim. Might be able to squeeze one more question in if anyone has a... No? Okay. But with that, ask Tim to close the meeting with the Serenity Prayer.
Thank you, everyone, for being here and for patiently listening. So would you please help me close with a Serenity Prayer? God, grant me the serenity.
Grant me serenity.
Accept the things I cannot change. Courage to change the things I can. And the wisdom to know the difference.
Thank you.
See you next week, everyone. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Tim. Thanks, guys.